how is this going to be received in the military? I'm still serving, I'm a senior officer, and I'm about to expose all of my vulnerabilities, my truth, and how will that be received? And I didn't know, because you don't know. If you bury it, it will come and bubble up in the future because it's unresolved, and it will always come up because, like a pot on the stove that's left to boil, the pressure will become too much and it spills over. And that's what happens with emotions that are caged and blocked. They will bubble up. I need to let my purpose far outweigh my fear, because if I can help just one person, the younger version of myself, then that is what it's all about.
Jackie's story is one you might not want to hear, but once you do, it's impossible to forget. When she joined the RAF, Jackie had a secret she was determined to bury, believing her scars were a sign of weakness. But her journey, both professional and personal, is one of immense bravery and resilience. Her most powerful choice? Turning the tables on her trauma and breaking the generational cycle of abuse. It's a story that does come with a trigger warning, as this episode includes discussion of sexual abuse and other distressing topics. Please listen with care. We have a range of resources and support listed in the show notes and on our website. Jackie's honesty, wisdom, strength, and her willingness to be vulnerable make her an extraordinary leader and someone we can all learn from. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Jackie.
So I'm in the Royal Air Force. I've served for 21 years and I'm a logistics officer who specialised in the movements arena. I'm currently serving in NATO, Joint Force Command Headquarters, which is in Naples. It's Operation, so J35. Quite a busy role. And I live there with my family, my husband and my two children, who are 5 and 7. It's nice to have a family kind of like overseas tour, which is good. My background in the RAF has primarily been in like logistics movements, serving in many different locations all over the world. Falklands and Afghanistan, in Cyprus previously as well. Really lovely career, very challenging and very varied across the years. I've also in the RAF competed in athletics for 10 years. It was a huge passion for me being part of that community. And I led that team for 5 years. We successfully became victorious at the Inter-Service Championships for 4 consecutive years whilst I was managing the team. I'm really proud of that team and that achievement. I became a heptathlete and earned some gold medals along the way at both RAF and inter-service level. And then when I had children, I kind of retired from that. I'm a fitness instructor as well outside of work. I'm also a passionate life coach and mentor, and I believe in leading with kindness, empathy and authenticity.
When you joined the Royal Air Force in 2003, you were determined never to tell them about your childhood experiences. And yet you've just written this amazing, challenging and compelling book about your childhood experiences. It's a real contrast from what you've just described. Can you explain to the listener what it is that your childhood was like?
Yeah, so what I was trying to explain before is that there's a professional mask of success, but actually behind this professional mask of success and all the accolades and all the achievements lies a story of courage, strength and resilience. Because what I had to go through as a child was extraordinarily challenging. You see, I'm a survivor of 9 different adverse childhood experiences, of which there are 10 in total. I had to endure physical and sexual abuse repeatedly from my father between the age of 6 and 12. My mother was a depressed alcoholic, and there would be emotional abuse in the form of shouting, screaming, yelling at me, criticizing, verbal abuse. And, you know, when she was passed out drunk, you know, she was neglecting me. So 4 different types of abuse, but there was also the household dysfunction. So I would witness their volatile and violent behavior towards one another. That behaviour I thought was normal growing up, which it's not. And then also when my father pleaded guilty for sexually abusing me, he was arrested and given a 2-year suspended custodial sentence. You know, the rug was pulled out from underneath my feet. This was really, really challenging. So I had all of these different adversities growing up and had to deal with that. And that was extraordinarily challenging. It really impacted my internal wiring. I was a very lonely child. I used to watch and observe life going on, not really playing a part of it. And the reason for that is that when you go through so much abuse, you tend to try and keep yourself safe by observing what's going on, and you become hyper alert, etc. By the time I reached 17, I tried to take my own life because I was such in a bad place. There was something calling to me saying, there's something going on, Jackie, and you need to really look deeply to know what's happening. And this was a crucible transformation in my life where I had a choice. I could either go, you know, left and follow the paths of my parents, or I could go straight over and actually follow the light and actually understand what's causing this discomfort inside of me. And I went to therapy and I reached out to an organization called ACCESS, which is for adult survivors of child sexual abuse. And I went to therapy for 12 months and it was extraordinarily difficult, but it was exactly what I needed to do. It was probably the best decision I ever made, you know, at such an early age, because it started me on my healing journey. I began to learn about myself and it reduced the fear that had built up inside of me because of what happened. And it helped me to identify the shame and the guilt that often survivors grow up with, and to start to minimize those, because I've received that external validation that it's not my fault. You can overcome this. You can learn more about yourself and grow from that.
In the period between your therapy, your year of therapy, you then went to university and then you chose to join the Royal Air Force. How did that happen?
I did languages at university and I spent 4 years at uni, went to France for a year and Spain for a year. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. Went to a careers fair, as you do. I was asking if anyone took on linguists. And the RAF gentleman on the store was like, yes, we do, in our intelligence branch. So that was the hook, because I was like, oh, James Bond. But I was too short-sighted to join the intelligence. So they offered me, it was called supply back then, but logistics branch. And I saw all the opportunities and I saw a home, somewhere where I could put down roots and feel part of something. And I didn't have that in my life. And that was a big calling for me. So I joined and never looked back.
In setting out your childhood experiences, you've been really honest and open. It's tough to listen to. But you then joined the Royal Air Force, something you were really passionate about doing, and then hid all of that away. Mm-hmm. Why did you hide it away?
It's a fascinating thing that because the feeling of shame and fear is so palpable when you're a survivor, you think that you have so little worth inside of you that you think that other people judge that as well. So I remember being at my officer and air crew selection interview and they asked me a question which I wasn't prepared for. They said, oh, you haven't mentioned your father on the application form. Why is that? And I was frozen at this point like a rabbit in the headlights and I didn't know how to answer the question, because I didn't have any courage to talk about it or resilience about what had happened. And it's the shame and fear that like stopped me in my tracks. And the fear was judgment, fear of rejection, fear of, well, you're not good enough to join the RAF as an officer because you've gone through this, you're going to be flawed. And I felt flawed. When you have this toxic shame that builds up inside of you, there's this feeling of flawed, I'm not good enough. And I've honestly believed that's what they would think. So I did what many people do, is you lock it into a box, you throw away the key, pretend it's never happened, and you just crack on. And I donned my body armor and mask of masculinity, and I vowed never to share my story, because I believe that being in the military, you just need to be strong. We defend, we protect, and actually you can't have people who are deemed to be weak with cracks in that organization. That was my belief at the time. And so I chose not to share it, but it's not a good way of living, if I'm honest.
How long did you hide that away for and keep it a secret?
I think for a good 8 years, I deployed to Afghanistan. Then when I came back, the wheels started to come off because I just felt like I couldn't be my full self when I was in leadership roles, etc. So I went back to therapy and started talking. And interestingly, my therapist once asked, she said, who would Jackie be without all the achievements and accolades? And I said, I'd be invisible. She then said, well, maybe you just need to start sharing your story. And it was through that encouragement. And I was like, well, how do I share with people what's happened? I don't even know where to begin. It's really difficult. And she said, just start at the present day and work your way backwards. And it was just that simple bit of advice that I thought, okay, I'll try this. And just with my closest friends who were in the RAF at the time, I just decided to share. And the response was so loving and supportive that it gave me faith that it's okay to share.
And did you have anyone else in the RAF that you knew or had heard about who was prepared to share this kind of a secret that you had?
There was someone who's no longer in the RAF. She shared that similar things had happened to her with a stepfather. It started opening up doors and beliefs that, oh, maybe there are more. Because you, when you don't speak about it, you just assume you're the only one. And actually, it's unique to you. But the more and more I've shared my story and the more I look at the statistics, I realise this impacts so many people. We just don't talk about it.
You then wrote this book. I'm trying to work out what the conditions were that made you write the book. Did something else change that made you feel that now was the right time?
So in 2016, I was diagnosed with complex PTSD as a result of my father passing away. He was no longer in my life, and I thought that his death would not impact me whatsoever, but it floored me. Out of the blue, he died of cancer, and I could not understand why I was struggling. And I think there was a little bit of, where's my justice? Like, what's happened? You know, where was my apology? All of these questions that remained unanswered that I was struggling to deal with. I had to be signed off work for 3 months because I had to do some more deep therapy to understand what was going on. After that point, I wrote a dissertation. I'd embarked on a master's about how primary socialization shapes how we narrate our adult behaviors and how that makes us develop as leaders. And I used myself as a case study. So I looked at my own abuse, how that impacts you, how that shapes you. And in doing so, I really, really got to, you know, the depths of understanding my values, my beliefs, how I'm shaped as an individual, but how I want to be as a leader. I graduated in 2017, and then I kind of left it alone and didn't do anything with it. But then fast forward to 2023, I decided to put my story into a book because the research that I had done, I thought, you know what, it's helped me so much that that's good for research. And if I can give that to other people to help their healing, how empowering would that be? And they say that the secret to living is giving. So I wanted to give, this is my roadmap. You're not alone, you can overcome. It's pretty rubbish at times, but it's not permanent, it's momentary, and you can overcome. And this is what I did. And these are the healthy healing strategies that I adopted along the way. Some of them I didn't even realize they were that healthy, but I did them because they felt good. And that is what empowered me. And that is why I wrote the book, because I just wanted to share that with just the younger Jackie that I know is out there.
And what impact has the book had?
It's been really positive. I've had so many people reach out to me saying how extraordinary and the courage that I've had to share my story, that they have been through similar things and that they've read the book and learned so much about why they feel the way that they feel, why they fear the way that they fear and how they view life. And it's helped them to make changes as well. And to me, it kind of makes my heart skip a beat. It really is so lovely that through my pain, I found a purpose to help people. And that's really empowering.
And I know that recently you've just been to talk at a conference about your experiences in your book. What impact has that had?
It was, once again, just people reaching out and wanting to learn more, because some people are in a place where they're still going through it. And you can hear the conversations that they're having with themselves. I think someone mentioned, I sound like a broken record because I keep going on about it all the time. Is that because that's what you're saying to yourself, or is it someone else saying that to you? But oftentimes the inner critic in a survivor's mind is really powerful. You berate yourselves, you put yourself down, you deem you're not good enough. There's all this negative chat in your mind. Where's that coming from? What are the stories you're telling yourself? And actually, when you can change the stories in your mind and the words that we use into more positive as opposed to negative, that can be really beneficial. Having these really open, honest conversations with people that can help them, I think, is really empowering, because I'm able to go, I think this used to happen to me. And then you can see them nodding, going, yeah, okay. And then they're like, oh, this is normal. So that means they then feel validated that actually it's not unusual. And I think it allows them to just to feel that it's accepted and move on.
And writing the book can be a very lonely thing. And you're going back to places that have been pretty dark and awful. Did you have a support network that you were able to reach into during that process?
Yeah, absolutely. So I joined a program, Perry Power. He published the book, and it's Powerful Books, publishing house. He's a survivor himself. And when I saw his story that he had written a book, I was inspired by this young guy who has been through so much, but was so brave to write his story. And he wanted to help survivors do the same thing. And because I'd already written my dissertation, which was not being read by anyone or not helping anyone, I was just like, this needs to take place. So I joined his program, and with this community, wrote the book. We had weekly calls where we support each other. And interestingly, one of my biggest fears when I was writing the book, I'd done a lot of healing, so there weren't many things that I was struggling with. But one of the things that I did struggle with was the fear, how is this going to be received in the military? I'm still serving, I'm a senior officer, and I'm about to expose all of my vulnerabilities, my truth, and how will that be received? And I didn't know, because you don't know. But I thought, you know what? I need to let my purpose far outweigh my fear, because if I can help just one person, the younger version of myself, then that is what it's all about.
And how did they react?
Really positively, just astoundingly supportive, and just almost amazed that you're sharing your story. It's that kind of like, wow. So in a positive way, there's been no negativity.
And no judgment at all either.
No.
Great. I mean, it's so good to hear. I mean, my children get upset when I use quotations, but I always think that the anticipation of the event is always worse than
yes,
the event itself.
Yes, absolutely.
You talked about kindness and your role as a leader. What I'm interested in is how different you are as a leader now, after you've written your book, than you were when you first started, that you were hiding part of you, and how that affected your ability to be an effective leader.
It's an interesting story that's in my book, a chapter called Echoes of Kindness. In 2008, this SAC, senior air craftsman, was working for me, and he was really struggling in the workplace. I became his commanding officer, and his previous boss had said to me that he's not performing, he's showing up to work late, shabby, there's something going on, he's not fit to be in the RAF, you know, we need to write him off. But then when I got to meet this individual, I knew that it was nothing to do with his potential, it was something deeper, and it was probably something from his past that was troubling him. And I brought him in for a chat, and because I've been through what I've been through, I could see that there was something to do with childhood. And I just suggested that he perhaps needs to see therapy or go and speak to someone. And you could see the kind of like fear in his face. And then I said, you didn't know how to load an aircraft or unload an aircraft before you had training on it, did you? It's like, no. Well, just imagine going to speak to someone is getting training on your mind so you understand how your mind operates, how your unconscious mind operates, but also how your behaviours come from your emotions, thoughts, and then your actions or inactions. And all of those things you can glean to why you're behaving the way you're behaving. And it was like a light bulb moment. Because I was able to share part of my story, I didn't say what had happened to me, but I said, you know, we all need therapy. I destigmatized going to speak to someone like it was just going for some training, and that massively helped. So he then went to speak to someone, it helped him, and now he's almost at the pinnacle of his career. It's just fascinating to watch him thrive and grow because he has reached his potential. He's an author. He's doing his master's. He's got his sights on doing the CAS fellowship and achieving his PhD. And he was being written off.
Amazing.
I think when you lead with kindness and without judgment, I think that's the most important thing. One of the proverbs I hold dear is never judge a book by its cover. Because you really do not know where that person has been, what they've experienced, what the events they've gone through when they're stood in front of you. So just treat everyone with kindness and without judgment.
You talked in your book about beliefs and values and how your beliefs were informed by your experiences as a young person, but now your beliefs are very different. There's a sense in many people who've worked in organisations that are value-based that values and beliefs stay the same. But it's really clear that your values and beliefs change radically because you did the thinking to work out what the right values were for you.
My values were probably born out of the voids in my life. They'd say that, you know, what's perceived to be lacking in your life is what you chase after. So as an example, I value financial stability because when I was growing up, there wasn't any. I value honesty and integrity because of the amount of secrets I had to grow up living with. When you learn to live by your values, you feel really deeply fulfilled. So it's really important to identify your values. And my top three values are health and fitness, but having a growth mindset, actually learning to change and understand and grow your mind is massively important. You hear the term learned helplessness, playing the victim your whole life. You don't need to be like that. We can actually really help ourselves to learn to grow and change our behaviours. You can actually understand yourself, educate yourself to grow. So all through the research that I've done, my values have changed and grown in relation to that. In relation to beliefs, I grew up with so many limiting beliefs because of what had happened. I believed that I wasn't worthy of love because I never really got unconditional love. It was dependent on when my parents decided to be nice. It wasn't all the time. So I believed that I was not a lovable child. Therefore, I'm not a lovable adult, and that grows up with you. I believed that I was never good enough. So in order to get a well done or level support from my father, it was through competitions. We used to do Gymkhana pony races, and I could get his love and support through achieving that. So my belief was, if I'm achieving, I'm doing well and I'll be recognised and I'll get that support. So that was a belief that I had to become a super achiever. But actually, your worth is not measured on the outside. It's an internal thing. And fulfillment comes from a deeper sense of awareness about who you are as an individual, as opposed to what you're achieving on the outside. When you do something to provide yourself with the evidence, which is the opposite to a belief, you can grow and change your belief. For example, I'm not a very good public speaker. It could be a belief, but actually when you step out and you do something, you provide yourself with the evidence and you get that feedback, you know, no, I can do this. That's how you change beliefs, by providing yourself with the evidence of actually that belief.
Hippocrates said that healing is a matter of time, but it's sometimes also a matter of opportunity. Has this been your experience?
Yeah. What I've always done in my life is face it head on. Whenever there's an opportunity for growth, I will jump in with both feet because I know the benefits. And even though it will be uncomfortable, because change is uncomfortable, it's actually really important to grow as an individual. So when my father passed away, I could have just buried that, brushed it under the carpet and not dealt with it. But I made a decision and I used that to learn and grow and to try and figure out why I was behaving in the way that I didn't want to be like. And that's quite a deep thing to do. So when you're reacting and responding, I was like, why am I being like this? Well, what was happening to me when he died is that the inner child of Jackie, the little Jack, she was really angry and she was really volatile. So in my adult self, I would be like that with my husband. I talk about it in my book and I would have schmoolies all the time. They say that you should name it to tame it. And so we named my episode. So a schmoolie is, it's like a flare in the military that goes up to identify the enemy, but it's like a firework. And I would erupt. The eruption would come from simple thing like, I feel like I'm being abandoned. So little Jackie, inner child, she's being abandoned again. And my husband, who was my boyfriend back then, was just going off somewhere, but I'm being abandoned. So, the schmoolie would go up. And all that he would need to do is just to give me a hug and go, I'm not going anywhere. I love you. This growth that I had to go through is understanding, why am I reacting to this scenario? Oh, it's because of abandonment issues. I'm okay. I'm safe. I'm loved. I don't need to respond like this anymore. And so you get to change those behaviors. And that's exactly what happened. I used this really dark place, which I call in my book, Beautiful Destruction. It was 12 months where I was in a really bad place, complex PTSD diagnosis after my father died and many other deaths in the family. And I was on a path to self-destruction, but actually I focused in, I tried to understand it. And then when you become aware of your reactions, you can raise the behavior from your unconscious sort of cognitive reactions into your conscious mind, and then you can get to change your behaviors. And that's neuroscience, that's rewiring your brain. And when you can objectify and go, that's a little child who's still broken, she's still upset, she's grieving the loss of never having a father who loved her, then you can heal it. And it's really important to go through that. Those are the opportunities that when it's hard and it's painful, just lean into that discomfort, because you'll come out the other end a lot more quickly. But if you bury it, it will come and bubble up in the future because it's unresolved, and it will always come up because, like a pot on the stove that's left to boil, the pressure will become too much and it spills over. And that's what happens with emotions that are caged and blocked. They will bubble up.
God, it's really powerful to hear that, Jackie. Thank you. I was just thinking how amazingly brave you are for doing this, because by going back and looking, I know that you say, well, it's better now, but it's really brave for you to be doing this, I think.
I don't consider myself to be courageous or brave, but people say that you are. I'm just doing what I think is right. Well, they say that brave leaders don't do what's easy, they do what's right. So all I'm trying to do is what I think is right. And I would just like to think that if my actions now can help someone else be courageous and follow in my footsteps, that would be so rewarding. They say that being courageous is contagious, and I'm hoping that just by sharing my story, it will help so many others to share theirs and heal.
I have no doubt that you're making a big impact on people's lives already. And is that what's led you to be part of the Defence Mental Health and Wellbeing Network?
Absolutely. When I saw there was an opportunity to join the committee, it's something that I thought I would love to get involved with, to be in a place, in a community where it's a safe space to talk about mental health, because it does impact many people in different ways for different reasons. I got the opportunity of creating coffee mornings, like an annual program. Mm-hmm. So we have a monthly coffee morning for the network, and inviting speakers to talk about different things, which is actually beneficial to help with mental health. Someone came on and spoke about the importance of sleep. And it's really, really powerful. If you're not getting sleep, you will be impacted more. So if you're struggling with your mental health and you're tired, it will exacerbate it. When we understand all of our habits and behaviors, how it impacts us, it's really important, because that can empower you. So just being a source of education in these different conversations is really good, but it allows people to share and contribute and feel part of something. Having that community support, I think it's crucial.
having those normalising conversations in a safe space is really helpful, I guess, for those people that are inside the network and who can listen in and join. But how does that relate into the chain of command? I mean, when you talked about your experiences, you said there was no judgment. Do you think increasingly there's less judgment about mental health?
Compared to 20 years ago, there's absolutely less stigma attached. Leaders are doing the right things by allowing these communities to be created. And I think that's really important that we're leading that. What I still sense might be an issue is that at certain levels, there'll be people that are like, well, I can't say this about that because I'll be judged. So that fear of judgment, I think, is still palpable, still exists. So we need leaders to own their story, because it's like a snowball effect. When you share your story, it will encourage others to be vulnerable and share their stories, which will in turn lead to their being able to get help or talk about stuff. When I've seen senior leaders talk about that, I'm really proud that they're doing that. I think it's so important. So we are moving in the right direction. The human condition is we will experience things and we will go through grievances, you know, death, all sorts of trauma that will affect us, and we have to be able to support that response to that. When they give out the uniform, they don't give out a load of attributes where you're only going to be strong and this, that and the other, and you will not be affected by any negativity in life. That's just impossible.
In your book, you talk about shame resilience. Do you find that now that you have shared your story, that you're building more shame resilience, that you're strengthening that resilience?
I think you do. I really do. I talk about in my book about toxic shame, which is where I feel internally flawed, like there's something wrong with me. But actually, the more you heal and the more you talk about what's happened, this resilience to that shame becomes really powerful, to the point where I have no qualms in talking about my story anymore with anyone. In fact, I probably surprise people about how open I am. It just shows that shame is not mine to carry. When I was given it as a child, it's no longer for me to keep. You become who you are when you learn to let go of who you are not. So I've let go of that shame. And by having these conversations, you just keep letting it go. And that builds your shame resilience.
And do you think there's something in the British culture or culture more broadly where people feel uncomfortable talking about things that are secrets? So I remember in your book, you talked about at your father's funeral, a man talked about how he didn't know the story because it had not been talked about. Do you think that there's something innate in the culture that makes people reticent to discuss things that are deemed to be distasteful or inappropriate for conversation?
Absolutely. It's a generational thing. I remember my mother telling me that when my father was going to court, my grandfather said to the solicitor, make sure you get him off. He's got the combine harvesting to do when he gets back. And it was just minimized, brushed under the carpet as if nothing had happened. There was no, what about the children? But I think generations previous, they didn't talk about emotions. And I think increasingly we're beginning to talk about our emotions. With my children, we absolutely identify what emotions are you feeling, because that's really important because they're part of our character. But I think culturally, we are not a society that talks much about feelings, and we do brush under the carpet. And I'm not sure that's necessarily the best way forward.
You joined the Royal Air Force in 2003, and that's arguably when you became a leader, yeah. But you've probably been a leader before that too. Now that you've gone through this whole journey, do you think that because of what you've learnt, you're now a more effective leader?
I absolutely believe that when you become self-aware, you really become a good leader, because you understand yourself and your own strengths, which allows you to connect with other people and lead them. That takes time to grow that awareness. I believe that leading with vulnerability and authenticity as a leader has made me a better leader.
Your book is full of wisdom and relevant advice for anyone, either who's experienced it themselves or is close to someone who might have had awful experiences as a young person, or even as an adult. It feels, when I read the book, I could just select whole paragraphs that are just great quotations that one should use in life. Do you have a favourite quotation?
Yes. One that I hold dearly is, "Be the change you wish to see in the world." And the reason for that is, when I read that, I was like, do you know what? I am the change. For breaking the generational cycle of abuse that happens, because this doesn't just start, you know, trauma lives in families, generations, and it just trickles down. I just wanted to make sure that when I had my children, that they would not experience anything that I've gone through. And that's really empowering. So I've broken the generational cycle for their sake. They will never know what it feels like to not receive unconditional love, because they will always get it. They will never know what it means to be criticized, yelled at, or shouted at, because they're always parented consciously and with kindness. So I'm trying to make sure they don't have limiting beliefs about their own worth, and that they are valuable and valued and loved exactly as they are. If I can do this, I know for a fact that everyone can do it. We just need to open our eyes and just learn more about our own behaviours and how that impacts other people, because children just absorb everything. They absolutely do. And I would like them to know just how much they are adored and loved.
Jackie, thank you so much for coming and talking so openly and honestly, powerfully as well, about your story. And I know that the subject matter we've been talking about has been challenging. And what's been remarkable is how brilliantly you've talked about it in a way that's really clear, but also has great impact. And I'm feeling that myself. How are you?
I'm absolutely fine. I've got to a point in my life where I am so happy and deeply fulfilled. Everything that I've been through, I'm now turning all of the negativity into positivity. I don't feel any sadness. So I've tried to turn the pain into purpose. And that's really powerful, because everyone can do that. When they allow faith to drive their behavior as opposed to the fears, they can all find the positivity. And it sometimes is really difficult, but I don't feel that anymore. I'm really happy in like what I'm doing, and the fact that I'm sharing my story. The secret to living is giving. And I want to give this hope and this opportunity for healing to so many people that might not be in that place yet.
Jackie feared her truth would cost her everything. Instead, the opposite is true. It became the foundation of her leadership. She's chosen the hardest path, and in doing so, unlocked her truly remarkable self, who knows the secret to living is giving. Her book, Turning the Tables on Trauma, is a challenging read, but an essential one for anyone looking to understand more, lead better, or grow. She shared so many phrases that stuck with me, like, purpose is more powerful than fear, leading with vulnerability and authenticity, and my personal favourite, you become who you are when you learn to let go of who you are not. What stood out for you? I'd love to hear your reflections. You can email me at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.